engine air inlets had deployed. As soon as their jet engines had begun to function, the Tomahawks began a shallow descent that ended 30 feet above the ground. Onboard radar systems scanned ahead to keep the missiles close to the ground, and to match the terrain with map coordinates stored in their computer memories. 6 separate Soviet radars detected the missiles' boost phase, then lost them as they went low. The Russian technicians, whose job it was to watch for a possible nuclear attack against their homeland, were every bit as tense as their Western counterparts, and the weeks of sustained conventional conflict, coupled with continuous maximum alert status, had frayed nerves to the breaking point. As soon as the Tomahawks had been detected rising from the sea, a ballistic missile attack warning had flashed to Moscow. Amethyst's visual missile warning arrived at naval headquarters in Severomorsk almost as fast, and a Thunderbolt alert sent immediately, the code word prefix guaranteeing instant passage to the Ministry of Defense. Launch authority for the anti-ballistic missiles deployed around Moscow was automatically released to the battery commanders, and though it was several minutes before radar officers were able to confirm to Moscow's satisfaction that the missiles had dropped off their scopes and were not on ballistic trajectories, defense units stayed on alert, and all over northern Russia, air defense interceptors scrambled. The missiles could not have cared about the furor they had caused. At this point, the Russian coast was composed of rocky bluffs and cliffs that gave way to tundra, the flat marsh of northern climes. It was ideal terrain for the cruise missiles, which settled down to a flight path scant feet over the grassy swamps at a speed of 500 knots. Each flew over Lake Babazero, their first navigational reference point, and there their flight paths diverged. The Soviet fighters now lifting off the ground had little idea what they were after. Radar information gave the course and speed of the targets, but if they were cruise missiles, they could reach as far as the Black Sea coast. They could even be targeted on Moscow and be flying a deceptive course far off the direct path to the Soviet capital. On orders from their ground controllers, the interceptors arrayed themselves south of the White Sea and switched on their look-down radars to see if they could spot the missiles crossing the flat surface. But they weren't going to Moscow. Dodging between the occasional hills, the missiles flew on a bearing of 213 until they reached the scrub pine forest. One by one, they banked hard to the right and changed course to 290. One missile went out of control and fell to the earth. Another failed to make the turn and went south. The rest continued to their targets. Sea Eagle 26. The last backfire bomber circled Umbazero south, waiting to land. The pilot checked his fuel. About 30 minutes left, there was not that much of a hurry. For security reasons, the 3 regiments were divided among 4 airfields clustered south of the mining city of Kirovsk. The tall hills around the town held powerful radars and mobile SAM batteries to stave off a NATO air attack. Most of the smelters were still operating, the pilot saw, the smoke rising from the many tall chimneys. "Sea Eagle 26, you are cleared to land," the tower said finally. "Who will it be tonight, Volodya?" 20 degrees of flaps, airspeed 200, landing gear is down and locked. Irina Petrovna, I think, the tall skinny one at the telephone exchange. "What's that?" the pilot asked. A small white object suddenly appeared over the runway in front of him. The first of 12 Tomahawk missiles assigned to Umbazero South cut across the runway at a shallow angle. Then the blunt nose cover sprang off the airframe, and several hundred small bomblets began to sprinkle over the area. 17 backfires were already on the ground. 10 were being refueled from trucks in the open. The others were armed and ready for another mission, dispersed in concrete revetments. Each bomblet was the equivalent of a mortar shell. The Tomahawk dropped its complete load, then climbed straight up, stalled, and crashed back to earth, adding its own fuel load to the destruction. A ready force backfire went first. 2 bomblets fell on its wing, and the bomber fireballed into the sky. The pilot of 26 advanced his throttles and climbed out of the landing pattern, watching in horror as 10 bombers exploded before his eyes and telltale puffs of smoke told him of less serious damage to many others. In 2 minutes it was over. Crash trucks raced like toys along the concrete as men played fire hoses on the burning trucks and aircraft. The pilot headed north for his alternate field and saw smoke rising there also. 15 minutes fuel. You'd better find us a place fast, Volodya warned. They turned left for Kirovsk South, and the same story was repeated. The attack had been timed for the missiles to hit all four targets simultaneously. Afrikanda, this is Sea Eagle 2-6. We are low on fuel and need to land immediately. Can you take us? Affirmative 2-6. Runway is clear. Wind is 265 at 20. Very well. We are coming in. Out. The pilot turned. What the hell was that? He asked Volodya. USS Chicago. Communications is gone. Fire control is gone. Fairwater plane's gone. We stopped the leaks. Engines are okay. We can steam, the skipper of USS Providence said over the Gertrude. Very well. Stand by. Boston was also alongside. Todd, this is Danny. What do you think? She won't make it out alone. I suggest we send the rest back out. You and me escort her. Agreed. You follow him out. We'll try to clear datum as quick as we can. Good luck, Danny. Boston raised her radio whip and made a quick transmission. A minute later, Chicago's sonar showed the noise of the other submarines racing north. Providence recommend you come to course 015 and go as fast as you can. We'll cover your tail. Boston will rendezvous later, and we'll both escort you to the pack. You can't risk it. We can... Move your fucking boat! McCafferty shouted into the microphone. He was exactly 3 months senior in rank to his counterpart on Providence. Presently, the wounded submarine dived and headed northeast at 15 knots. Her damaged sail structure sounded like a junk wagon in the water flow, but there was nothing they could do about it. If the submarines were to have any chance of survival, they had to put as much distance between themselves and the firing point as they could. Moscow, RSFSR. Mikhail Sergeyev looked around at a group of men still pale at what might have been. Comrade Defense Minister, the General Secretary said. Can you tell us what has happened?
It would seem that submarines launched a number of cruise missiles at some of our northern airfields. Their aim was evidently to destroy a number of our backfire bombers. How successful they were, I do not yet know.
Where did they launch their missiles from? Pyotr Bromkovsky asked.
East of Murmansk, less than 30 kilometers from our coast. A frigate saw and reported the launch, then went off the air. We have aircraft searching for him now.
How the hell did he get there? If that submarine had launched ballistic missiles at us, Bromkovsky demanded, how much warning would we have had?
6 to 7 minutes.
Wonderful! We cannot react that fast. How can you let them get so close?
They won't get out, Petya, I promise you that, the defense minister replied heatedly.
The General Secretary leaned forward.
You will see to it that this can never happen again.
While we are all here, comrades, Sergeyev spoke up, can the comrade defense minister review overnight developments on the German front?
NATO forces are strained to the breaking point. As the KGB has told us, their supplies are critically low, and with the diplomatic developments of the past few days, I think we may safely assume that NATO is on the verge of political disintegration. All we have to do is keep the pressure on, and they must collapse.
But we are running out of fuel also, Bromkovsky said. The offer the Germans have given us is a reasonable one.
No, the foreign minister shook his head emphatically. This gives us nothing.
It gives us peace, comrade, Bromkovsky said quietly.
If we continue...
Consider, my friends, consider what we were all thinking a few hours ago when the rocket warning came in.
For the first time, Sergeyev realized, the old man had made a point they all agreed with.
After weeks and months of promises and plans and assurances on how things could be kept under control,
That one false alarm had forced them to look at what lay over the edge of the abyss. For 10 minutes they feared that control had been lost, and all the defense minister's bluster could not make them forget that. After a moment of consideration, the general secretary spoke. Our representatives are meeting with the Germans in a few hours. The foreign minister will report to us tomorrow on the substance of their new offer. On that note, the session ended. Sergeyev tucked his notes in his leather briefcase, left the room alone, and walked downstairs to his official car. A junior aide held the door open when a voice called.
"Mikhail Eduardovich, may I ride with you? My car has broken down."
It was Boris Kossov, chairman of the Committee for State Security, the KGB. Chapter 36. Shootout at 31 West. Moscow, RSFSR.
"Shall we take a drive today, Mikhail Eduardovich? Perhaps we can talk."
Sergeyev's blood chilled, though he did not let it show. Was it possible for the chief of the KGB not to look sinister, he wondered. From Leningrad, like Sergeyev, Kossov was a short, rotund man who had taken over the KGB after running the Central Committee's shadowy General Department. He had a jolly laugh when he wanted to, and in another guise could be the personification of Grandfather Frost, the state's acceptable version of Santa Claus. But he was not in another guise now.
"Certainly, Boris Georgievich," Sergeyev said, and pointed at his driver.
"You may speak freely. Vitali is a good man."
"I know it," Kossov replied. "He's worked for us the last 10 years.
Sergeyev only had to watch the back of his driver's neck to know that Kossov spoke the truth.
"So what shall we talk about?"
The director of the KGB reached into his briefcase and came out with a device about the size of a paperback book. He flipped a switch, and it gave off an unpleasant buzz.
"A clever new device made in the Netherlands," he explained. "It gives off a noise that renders most microphones useless. Something to do with harmonics, my people tell me."
Then his manner changed abruptly.
"Mikhail Eduardovich, do you know the significance of the American attack on our airfields?"
"A troublesome development, to be sure, but
I thought not. Several NATO convoys are at sea. A major one left New York several days ago. It carries 2 million tons of essential war material, plus a complete American division to Europe. In destroying a number of our bombers, NATO has significantly reduced our ability to deal with the convoys. They have also cleared the way for direct attacks against Soviet soil. But Iceland has been neutralized."
Kossov explained what had happened to the Soviet fighters at Keflavik.
"You're telling me the war goes badly? Then why is Germany making overtures for peace?"
"Yes, that is a very good question.
If you have suspicions, Comrade Director, you should not bring them to me."
"I will tell you a story. Back in January, when I had my bypass surgery, day-to-day control of KGB passed to the first deputy chairman, Joseph Larionov."
"Have you met little Joseph?" Kossov asked.
"No, he never took your place at Politburo meetings."
"What about the Defense Council?"
Sergeyev's head snapped around.
"They did not consult you. You were recovering then."
"An exaggeration. I was quite ill for 2 weeks, but naturally this information was kept quiet. It took another month before I was back working full-time. The members of the Defense Council had no wish to impede my recovery, and so young, ambitious Joseph was called in to give KGB's official intelligence assessment. As you might imagine, we have many schools of thought in the intelligence services. It is not like your precious engineering, where all things are broken into neat little numbers and graphs.
We have to look inside the heads of men who often as not do not themselves know what they think on an issue. Sometimes I wonder why we do not employ gypsy fortune-tellers. But I digress. KGB maintains what we call the Strategic Intelligence Estimate. This is a document updated on a daily basis which gives our assessment of the political and military strength of our adversaries. Because of the nature of our work, and because of serious mistakes made in the past, we have three assessment teams who make the estimate. Best case, worst case, and middle case. The terms are self-explanatory, are they not? When we make a presentation to the Politburo, we generally use the middle case estimate. And for the obvious reasons, we annotate our estimates with data from the other two. So, when he was called in to give his assessment to the Politburo, yes. Young Joseph, the ambitious little bastard who wants my job as a wolf wants a sheep, was clever enough to bring all three with him. When he saw what they wanted, he gave them what they wanted. But when you returned, why didn't you correct the mistake? Kossoff gave his companion an ironic smile. Misha, Misha, sometimes you can be most engagingly naive. I should have killed the son of a bitch, but this was not possible. Joseph suffers from poor health, though he is not aware of it. The time is not yet right, Kossoff said, as though discussing a vacation. KGB is split into several factions at the moment. Joseph controls one. I control another. Mine is larger, but not decisively so. He has the ear of the General Secretary and the Defense Minister. I am a sick old man. They have told me this. Except for the war, I would have been replaced already. But he lied to the Politburo, Sergeyev nearly shouted. Not at all. You think Joseph is foolish? He handed over an official KGB intelligence estimate drawn up under my chairmanship by my department heads. Why is he telling me all this? He fears losing his post, and he wants support with other Politburo members. Is that all? You're telling me that this is all a mistake? Exactly, Kossoff answered. Bad luck and poor judgment in our oil industry. Not your fault, of course. Add some fear in the hearts of our party hierarchy, some ambition in one of my subordinates, the defense minister's sense of importance, and outright stupidity on the part of the West, and here we are today. So what do you think we should do? Sergeyev asked warily. Nothing. I ask that you keep in mind, however, that the next week will probably decide the outcome of our war. Ah! he exclaimed. Look, my car has been repaired. You may pull over here, Vitali. Thank you for the ride, Misha. Good day. Kossoff retrieved his jamming device and stepped out of the car. Mikhail Eduardovich Sergeyev watched the KGB limousine pull away and disappear around the corner. He had played many power games in his life. Sergeyev's climb up the party ladder had been more than an exercise in efficiency. Men had stood in his way and needed brushing aside. Promising careers had been broken so that he could sit in this Zeal automobile and aspire to real power in his country. But never had the game been this dangerous. He didn't know the rules, was not sure what Kossoff was really up to. Was his story even true? Might he be trying to cover his own flanks for errors he had made and blame it all on Joseph Larionov? Sergeyev could not recall ever meeting the first deputy chairman. Straight to the office, Vitali, Sergeyev ordered. He was too deep in thought to worry about his driver's other activities. Northwood, England. Toland scanned the satellite photographs with great interest. The KH-11 satellite had passed over Kirovsk 4 hours after the missile attack,
and the signals sent by real-time link to the NATO command center. There were 3 frames for each of the backfire bases. The intelligence officer took out a pad and started his tally, commanding himself to be conservative. The only aircraft he counted as destroyed were those with large pieces broken or burned off. "We figured a total force of about 85 aircraft. Looks to me like 21 totally destroyed, and another 30 or so damaged. The base facilities took a real beating. The only other thing I'd like to know is how hard their personnel were hit. If we killed a lot of crews, too. The backfires are out of business for at least a week. They still have the Badgers, but those birds have shorter legs. They're a lot easier to kill. Admiral, it's a new ball game." Admiral Sir Charles Beatty smiled. His intelligence chief had said almost exactly the same thing. Langley Air Force Base, Virginia. The F-15 interceptor streaked over the runway at a height of 100 feet. As she passed the tower, Major Nakamura threw her fighter into a slow roll, then turned around for a more sedate landing. She was an ace. 3 Badger bombers and 2 satellites. The first female ace in the history of the U.S. Air Force. The first space ace. She rolled to a stop at the ready shelter, jumped off the ladder, and ran to the reception committee. The deputy commander of Tactical Air Command was red-faced with anger. "Major, if you ever pull something like that again, I'll bust your ass back to Dooley." "Yes, sir. Sorry, sir." She grinned. Nothing was going to spoil today. "Won't ever happen again, sir. You only make ace once, sir." "Intelligence says Ivan has 1 more Rorsat ready to use. Probably they'll think it over some before launching," the general said, calming down somewhat. "Have they put any more birds together?" Buns asked. "They're working on 2, and we might have them by the end of the week. If we get them, your next target will be their real-time photo reconnaissance satellite. Until then, the Rorsats have highest priority." The general smiled briefly. "Don't forget to paint that 5th star on the bird, Major." Norfolk, Virginia. They would have sailed anyway. The destruction of the Soviet Rorsat merely made it safer. First came the destroyers and frigates, fanning out, looking for submarines under an umbrella of patrol aircraft. Then the cruisers and carriers. Last of all came the ships from Little Creek, Tarawa, Guam, Nassau, Incheon, and 20 more. Over 60 ships in all, they formed into 3 groups and steamed northeast at 20 knots. It would be a 6-day trip. USNS Prevail. Even at 3 knots, she didn't ride well. The ship was just over 200 feet long, and she responded to every wave like a horse to a fence. She had a mixed crew, not really Navy, not really civilian. The civilians ran the ship. The naval personnel ran the electronics gear. The really amazing thing, everyone agreed, was that they were still alive. Prevail was an adaptation of a blue-water fishing boat. Instead of a trawl, she pulled a sonar array at the end of a 6,000-foot cable filled with sonar sensors. The signals received were pre-processed by onboard computers, then sent via satellite to Norfolk at a rate of 32,000 bits of data per second. The ship was driven by quiet electric motors, and her hull had been installed with the Prairie Masker system to eliminate even her tiny amount of machinery noise. Her topsides were made of fiberglass to reduce her radar signature. In a very real sense, she was one of the first stealth ships, and despite the fact that she carried no weapon other than a rifle for dealing with sharks, she was also the most dangerous anti-submarine platform ever made. Prevail and 3 sister ships were cruising the North Atlantic on the Great Circle route between Newfoundland and Ireland, listening for the telltale noise of a submarine in transit. 2 already had kills painted up on their bridges, since each had an Orion patrol aircraft in constant attendance, and Soviet submarines had twice had the misfortune to approach one of them. But their job was not to kill submarines. It was to warn others of them far away. In the midships operations center of Prevail, a team of oceanographic technicians watched a bank of TV-type display tubes, while others worked up tracks of anything that might be close enough to be a direct threat. A petty officer ran his finger down a fuzzy line on the display. "That must be the convoy from New York."
"Yeah," said the technician next to him. "And there are the folks who want to meet them."
USS Reuben James.
"At least we're not going to be lonely," O'Malley observed.
"You always have such a positive attitude?" Frank Ernst inquired.
"Our Russian friends must have excellent intelligence. I mean, your Air Force chaps did kill their satellite."
Captain Perrin set his coffee down on the table. The five officers conferred in Morris's stateroom. Perrin had flown over by helicopter from Battle Axe.
"Yeah, so they know our composition," Morris said. "And they'll want to cut this bunch down to size."
The message from Norfolk stated in clipped navalese that at least six Soviet submarines were believed to be heading for the convoy. Four would be on the north. That was their area of responsibility.
"We should be getting some data off the tail any time now," Morris said.
"Jerry, you up to 3 days of continuous ops?"
O'Malley laughed.
"If I say no, will it matter?"
"I think we should remain close together," Perrin said. 5 mile separation at most. The real trick will be timing our sprints. The convoy wants to make as straight a run as possible, right?"
"Yeah," Morris nodded.
"Hard to blame the Commodore for that. Zigzagging all those ships could create almost as much confusion as a real attack."
"Hey, the good news is no more backfires for a while," O'Malley pointed out. "We're back to a one-dimension threat."
The ship's motion changed as power was reduced. The frigate was ending a 28-knot sprint, and would now drift for several minutes at 5 knots to allow her passive sonar to function.
USS Chicago.
"Sonar contact bearing 346.
700 miles to the ice pack," McCafferty thought as he went forward. "At 5 knots. They were in deep water. It was a gamble, but a good one, to run away from the coast at 15 knots, despite the noise Providence made. It had taken 4 hours to reach the 100-fathom curve, a period of constant tension, as he had worried about the Russian reaction to their missile attack. The Russians had sent anti-submarine patrol aircraft first of all, the ubiquitous bears-dropping sonoboys. But they'd been able to avoid them. Providence still had most of her sonar systems in operation, and though she could not defend herself, she could at least hear the danger coming. Throughout the 4-hour run, the wounded submarine had sounded like a wagon load of pipes, and McCafferty didn't want to think about how she had handled, with her Fairwater planes hanging like laundry in a breeze. But that was behind them. Now they were in 700 feet of water. With their towed array sonars deployed, they'd have an extra measure of warning for approaching danger. Boston and Chicago cruised 3 miles on either side of their wounded sister.
700 miles at 5 knots, McCafferty thought. Almost 6 days.
"Okay, what do we have here, Chief?"
"Came in slowly, sir, so it's probably direct path. We have a slow bearing change rate. My first guess would be a diesel boat on batteries and close."
The sonar chief showed no emotion.
The captain leaned back into the attack center.
"Come right to 025.
The helmsman applied 5 degrees of right rudder, gently bringing the submarine to a northeasterly course. At 5 knots, Chicago was a hole in the ocean that made almost no noise at all. But her contact was almost as quiet. McCafferty watched the line on the screen change shape ever so slightly over a period of several minutes.
Okay, we have a bearing change to the contact. Bearing is now 341.
Joe?
McCafferty asked his executive officer.
I make the range 8,000 yards, plus or minus.
He's on a reciprocal heading, speed about 4 knots.
Too close, the captain thought.
He probably doesn't hear us yet, though.
Let's get him.
The Mark 48 torpedo fired at its slowest speed setting, turned 40 degrees to the left on leaving the tube, then settled down to head for the contact, its guidance wires trailing back to the submarine. The sonarman directed the fish toward its target, while Chicago moved slowly away from the launch point. Suddenly, the sonar chief's head jerked up.
He's heard it. He just kicked his engines. I got a blade count. It's a Foxtrot class doing turns for 15. Transient. Transient. He just flooded tubes.
The torpedo accelerated and switched on its homing sonar. The Foxtrot knew it had been found, and her captain reacted automatically, increasing speed and ordering a radical turn to starboard, then firing a homing torpedo back down the line of bearing at its attacker. Finally, he dove deep, hoping to shake off the closing fish. The hard turn left a knuckle in the water, an area of turbulence which confused the Mark 48 briefly. But then the torpedo charged right through it, and on coming back to undisturbed water found its target again. The green-painted weapon dove after the Foxtrot and caught it at a depth of 400 feet.
Bearing is changing rapidly on the inbound, the sonar chief said. It's going to pass well aft of us.
Hit! We got a hit on the target.
The sound echoed through the steel hull like distant thunder.
McCafferty plugged in a set of phones in time to hear the Foxtrot's frantic attempt to blow to the surface, and the screech of metal as the internal bulkheads gave way. He did not hear the captain's last act. It was to deploy the rescue buoy located on the aft corner of the sail. The buoy floated to the surface and began transmitting a continuous message. All the men aboard the Foxtrot were already dead, but the rescue buoy told their fleet headquarters where they had died, and several submarines and surface ships immediately set off to that point.
USS Reuben James.
O'Malley pulled up on the collective control and climbed to 500 feet. From this height, he could see the northern edge of the convoy off to the southwest. Several helicopters were in the air. A good idea of someone's. Many of the merchant ships were carrying army helicopters as deck cargo, and most of them were flyable. Their crews were taking them up to patrol the convoy perimeter, looking for periscopes. The one thing any submariner would admit to being afraid of was a helicopter. This procedure was called Black Sky ASW. Throughout the convoy, soldiers were being told to watch the ocean and report anything they saw, which made for many false sighting reports, but it gave the men something to do, and sooner or later they might just spot a real periscope. The Seahawk moved 20 miles east before circling. They were looking for a possible submarine detected on the frigate's passive sonar array during the last drift.
Okay, Willie, drop a lofar. Now, now, now.
The petty officer punched a button to eject a sonoboy out the side panel. The helicopter continued forward, dropping four additional buoys at intervals of 2 miles to create a 10-mile barrier. Then O'Malley held his aircraft in a wide circle, watching the sea himself as the petty officer examined the sonar display on his screen.
"Commander, what's this I hear about the skipper? You know, the night before we sailed."
"I felt like getting drunk, and he was kind enough not to make me drink alone."
"Didn't you ever get drunk before?"
"No, sir, I don't drink."
"What's this Navy coming to?"
"You take her for a minute."
O'Malley took his hand off the stick and adjusted his helmet. It was a new one, and he hadn't quite gotten used to it yet.
"You got anything, Willie?"
"Not sure yet, sir. Give me another minute or two."
"Fair enough."
The pilot contemplated his instruments briefly, then resumed his outside scanning.
"I ever tell you about this 35-footer in the Bermuda to Newport race? Storm beat hell out of it.
Anyway, it had an all-girl crew, and when the boat swamped, they lost all their...
Skipper, I got a weak signal on number 4.
Grateful as hell for being rescued, too.
O'Malley took the stick and brought the helicopter around to the northwest.
You don't do any of that either, Mr. Ralston?
Strong drink giveth the desire, sir, but taketh away the ability, the co-pilot said. 2 more miles, sir.
He even knows Shakespeare. There may be hope for you yet.
Talk to me, Willie.
Still a week on number 4.
Nothing else.
1 mile, Ralston said, watching the tactical display.
O'Malley's eyes scanned the surface, looking for a straight vertical line or a wisp of foam.
Number 4's signal strength is now medium, sir. Getting a twitch on 5.
Romeo, Hammer, I think we may have something here. I'm going to drop another low far between 4 and 5. Designate this one number 6. Dropping now.
Another sonoboy was ejected clear of the aircraft.
Hammer, this is Romeo, called the controller. Looks to us like the contact is north of the line. Say again, north.
Roger, concur on that.
We ought to know something in a minute.
Skipper, Willie called, I have a medium on 6.
Romeo, Hammer, we're going to dip on this character right now.
Aboard Reuben James, they marked the helicopter's position, along with the line of sonoboys.
O'Malley eased back on the stick to kill forward velocity, while his other hand eased the collective control down very gently until the helicopter was in hover 50 feet over the water. Willie unlocked the dipping sonar and lowered it to a depth of 200 feet.
Sonar contact, sir. Classify as possible submarine bearing 356.
Up dome, O'Malley commanded.
The Seahawk lifted high and raced north for 1 mile. Hovering once more, O'Malley dipped his sonar a second time.
Contact, bearing 175. Sounds like a twin screw doing turns for maybe 10 knots.
We've bracketed him, the pilot said.
Let's set this one up.
Ralston entered the numbers into the tactical computer.
Bearing change. Looks like he's turning to port.
Yeah, Willie confirmed. Turning to port.
He hear us? Ralston asked.
He might hear the convoy and be turning to get a fix on them.
Willie, up dome, O'Malley ordered.
Romeo, Hammer, we have a maneuvering target. Classify as probable submarine. Request weapons free.
Roger, Hammer, weapons free. Repeat, weapons are free.
The pilot flew 1,000 yards southeast. The sonar dome went down again, and the helicopter hovered head into the wind.
Got him again, sir, Willie said excitedly. Bearing 355. Bearing is changing right to left, sir.
Going right past us, Ralston said, looking at the TACNAV.
Romeo, this is Hammer. We're calling this a positive submarine, and we are making a deliberate attack on this contact.
O'Malley held the aircraft in hover as his petty officer called off the bearing change.
Attack sequence.
Master arm.
Ralston ran his hands across the buttons. Torpedo select, position 1.
Set initial search depth, 250. Course select, snake.
Ralston made the proper settings.
Set.
Okay, Willie, get ready for Yankee search, O'Malley ordered, meaning a search using active sonar.
Ready, sir. Bearing to contact now 200, changing right to left rapidly.
Hammer his ass.
O'Malley switched the sonar signals into his headset.
Willie thumbed the button and the sonar transducer fired off a series of pings. The wave fronts of sound energy reflected off the submarine's hull and came back to the transducer. The contact suddenly increased engine power.
Positive contact, bearing 188, range 800 yards.
Ralston fed the last numbers into the fire control system.
Set.
The pilot brought his thumb across the stick to a button on the right side and pressed it home. The Mark 46 torpedo dropped free of its shackles and plunged into the sea.
Torp away.
Willie, secure pinging.
O'Malley keyed his radio.
Romeo, we just dropped on a diving two-screw submarine approximately 800 yards from us on a bearing of 188. Torpedo is in the water now. Stand by. The Mark 46 torpedo was set on a snake pursuit pattern, a series of undulating curves that carried it in a southerly direction. Alerted by the helicopter's sonar, the Soviet submarine was running at flank speed and diving to evade the torpedo. Hammer, Romeo, be advised that Hatchet is en route to you in case your torp misses. Over.
Roger that, O'Malley acknowledged.
It's got him, Willie said excitedly. The torpedo was on automatic pinging as it closed with the submarine. The captain made a hard right turn, but the fish was too close to be fooled.
Hit! That's a hit!
Willie said almost as loudly as the noise of the explosion. Directly ahead of them, the surface seemed to jump, but no gout of foam leaped up. The torpedo had gone off too deep for that.
Well, O'Malley said.
In all his years of practice, he'd never fired a live fish at a live sub. The sounds of the dying sub seemed the saddest thing he'd ever heard. Some oil bubbled to the surface.
Romeo, we're calling that one a kill. Tell the bosun to get out his paintbrush. We are now orbiting to look for wreckage and possible survivors.
Another frigate had rescued the entire crew from a downed Russian bear the previous day. They were already on the mainland for interrogation. But there would be none from this incident. O'Malley circled for 10 minutes, then turned for home. Iceland.
Beagle, you all fed and rested? Doghouse asked.
I guess you could say that.
Edwards had been waiting for this, but now that it had come, it sounded ominous enough.
We want you to patrol the southern shore of the Famsfjordr and let us know of any Russian activity you see. We are particularly interested in the town of Stykkisholmer. That's a small port about 40 miles west of you. As before, your orders are to evade, observe, and report. You got that?
Roger.
How long we got?
I can't say that, Beagle. I don't know.
You want to move right along, though?
Okay, we'll be moving in 10 minutes. Out.
Edwards dismantled the antenna, then stowed the complete radio assembly in the backpack.
People, it's time to leave this mountain retreat.
Sergeant Nichols?
Yes, sir.
Nichols and Smith came over together.
Were you briefed on what we're supposed to be up to?
No, sir. Our orders were to relieve your party and await further instructions.
Edwards had already seen the sergeant's map case. He had cards for the whole western Icelandic coast, all but their drop zone in a pristine condition. Of course, the purpose of their coastal reconnaissance was clear enough, wasn't it? The lieutenant took out a tactical map and plotted their course west. Okay, we'll pair off. Sergeant Smith, you take the point along with one of our new friends. Nichols, you take Rogers with you and cover the back door. You both have a radio, and I'll take the third and keep the rest of the party with me. The group stay within sight of each other. We keep to the high ground as much as possible. The first hard surface road we hit is 10 miles west of here. If you see anything, you drop and report in to me. We are supposed to avoid contact.
No hero crap, okay?
Good.
We'll move out in 10 minutes.
Edwards assembled his gear.
Where do we go, Michael? Vigdis asked.
Stykkisholmer, he added.
You feel okay?
I can walk with you, yes.
She sat down beside him.
And when we get to Stykkisholmer?
Mike smiled.
They didn't tell me that.
Why they never tell you anything?
It's called security. That means the less we know, the better it is for us.
Stupid, she replied.
Edwards didn't know how to explain that she was both right and wrong. I think when we get there, we can start thinking about a normal life again. Her face changed.
What is normal life, Michael?
Another good question, Edwards thought. But I have too much on my mind to chew that one over.
We'll see.
Stendal, German Democratic Republic. The battle for Hameln and the battle for Hanover were now essentially the same action. 2 hours before, the NATO forces had withdrawn to the west, south of the industrial city, allowing them to shorten lines and consolidate. Soviet units were probing forward cautiously, suspicious of another German trap. Alexeyev and Commander-in-Chief West pored over their maps in an attempt to analyze the consequences of the NATO withdrawal.
It allows them to put at least one, probably two brigades in reserve, Alexeyev thought. They can use this Highway 217 to move troops rapidly from one sector to another.
How often have the Germans given ground voluntarily? His superior asked.
They didn't do this because they wanted to. Their lines were overextended. Their units are depleted.
So are ours. The Category B units we are committing to battle are taking losses almost a third greater than the A units they replace. We are paying dearly for our advances now.
We have paid dearly already. If we fail now, it will all have been for nothing.
Pasha, we must attack in force. This entire sector is ready to collapse.
Comrade General, that is not my impression. Resistance is spirited. German morale remains high despite their losses. They have hurt us badly, and they know it.
Alexeyev had returned from the forward command post at Fulzihausen only 3 hours before.
Viewing the action from the front lines is very useful, Pasha, but it hinders your ability to perceive the larger picture.
Alexeyev frowned at that. The larger picture was frequently an illusion. His commander had told him that very thing many times.
I want you to organize an attack along this entire front. NATO formations are gravely depleted. Their supplies are low. They have taken massive casualties. A vigorous attack now will sunder their lines on a 50-kilometer front.
We don't have enough A units to attack on this scale, Alexeyev objected.
Keep them in reserve to exploit the breakthrough. We'll launch the attack with our best reserve divisions from Hanover in the north to Bodenwerder in the south.
We don't have the strength for that, and it will use up too much fuel, Alexeyev warned.
If we have to attack, I suggest an assault on a 2-division front here, south of Hameln. The units are in place. What you propose is too ambitious.
This is not a time for half measures, Pasha, Sinkwest shouted.
He'd never raised his voice to Alexeyev before. The younger man found himself wondering what pressure was being applied to his commander, who calmed down now.
An attack along a single axis allows a counterattack along a single axis, he continued. This way we can greatly complicate the enemy's task. He can't be strong everywhere. We will find a weakness, break out, and drive our remaining A units through to the Rhine.
USS Reuben James.
Drop! Now! 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 O'Malley yelled.
The 8th Sonoboy ejected from the side of the Seahawk, and the pilot brought the helicopter around and headed back east. O'Malley had already been up for 3 long, grueling hours this time, with precious little to show for it. Stop, dip, listen. Stop, dip, listen. He knew there was a sub down there, but every time he thought he was beginning to get a line on it, the damn thing slipped away. What was it doing different? Hatchet was having the same problem, except its sub had turned around on it and nearly scored a hit on Battle Axe. The frigate's violent wake turbulence had detonated the Russian torpedo astern. But it had been close, too close by half. He brought the helicopter into hover.
Down dome!
They hovered for a minute. Nothing. It began again.
Romeo, this is Hammer. You got anything? Over.
Hammer, he just faded out a moment ago. Our last bearing was 341.
Cute. This character's listening for you to stop your sprint, and he cuts his power back.
That's a fair guess, Hammer, Morris said.
Okay, I got a barrier to the west if he heads that way. I think he's going due south, and we're dipping for him now. Out.
O'Malley switched to intercom.
You got anything, Willie?
Nothing, sir.
Prepare to raise dome.
A minute later, the helicopter was moving again. They dipped their sonar 6 more times in the next 20 minutes and came up blank.
Again, Willie, prepare to lower. Set it down to 800 feet this time.
Ready, sir.
Down dome.
O'Malley squirmed in his seat. The outside temperature was moderate, but the sun made a greenhouse of the cockpit. He'd need a shower when he got back to the frigate.
Searching at 800 feet, sir, the petty officer said.
He was hot, too, though he'd brought a pair of cold drinks along for the flight.
Sir, I have something. Possible contact bearing 185.
Up dome.
Romeo, Hammer, we got a possible contact south of us. Going after it now.
Hammer, we have nothing anywhere near you. Be advised Bravo and Hatchet are working a contact. Two torps have been launched with no hits.
Nobody ever said it was easy, the pilot thought.
He moved 3,000 yards and dipped the sonar again.
Contact, this one's for real. Type 2 engine plant bearing 183.
O'Malley checked his fuel. 40 minutes. He had to get this one in a hurry. He ordered the dome up again and went another 3,000 yards south. His shoulders flexed against the seat straps. It seemed to take forever for the sonar dome to get down to search depth.
There it is again, sir, north of us, bearing 013. Bearing is changing. 015 now.
Set it up.
30 minutes fuel. Time was their enemy now. Ralston punched up the master arm and select buttons.
Willie, Hammer!
The sonar sent out 5 ranging pings.
019, range 900.
Ralston set search depth and pattern. O'Malley brought his thumb across the stick and dropped the torpedo. The submarine went to full power and turned left away from the helicopter, while the torpedo plunged to 800 feet before beginning its search. O'Malley growled to himself that he'd launched from a bad angle, but it would have taken too long to reel in and reacquire. He held the aircraft in hover and listened over his headset as the whine of the torpedo screws chased after the deeper thrum of the Charlie's powerful twin screws. The nuclear sub maneuvered frantically, trying to turn inside the pursuing torpedo.
"They're on the same bearing now," Willie reported. "I think the fish has him. Hit!"
But the Charlie didn't die. They heard the sound of blowing air, then it stopped. A wild cacophony of mechanical noise followed as the contact moved off to the north, then faded as the submarine slowed. O'Malley didn't have enough fuel to pursue. He came around west and headed for Reuben James.
Hammer, Romeo, what happened? We hit him, but he's still alive. Stand by, Romeo, we're coming in skosh fuel. 5 minutes out.
Roger that, we'll be ready for you.
We're vectoring another helo under the Charlie. I want you to join Hatchet.
How come we didn't kill him? Ralston asked.
Almost all Russian subs have double hulls, and that dinky 100-pound warhead on the Mark 46 isn't gutsy enough to give you a kill every time. You try to attack from the stern if you can, but this time we couldn't. If you get a stern hit, you pop the shaft seals and flood his engine room. That'll kill anybody. They didn't tell you to go for a stern shot in school, did they?
Not especially.
Figures, O'Malley growled.
It was good to see the Reuben James after 4 hours. It would have been even better to visit the officer's head, O'Malley thought bleakly. He brought the Seahawk over the port corner of the frigate's stern and paced the ship. Aft, Willie opened the sliding door and tossed down a messenger line. The frigate's deck crew attached a refueling hose to the line and Willie hauled it in, plugging the hose into the fuel tank. The procedure was called HIFR, for Helicopter In-Flight Refueling. While O'Malley fought his helo through the roiled air behind the ship, fuel was pumped into his tanks, giving him another 4 hours' endurance. Ralston kept his eyes on the fuel indicators while O'Malley flew the aircraft.
"We're full up, Willie. Secure."
The petty officer lowered the fuel hose and retrieved his line. He was glad to close the door and strap himself back into his chair.
Officers, he told himself, were too smart to do what he just did. "Bravo, this is Hammer. Where do you want us? Over."
"Hammer, Bravo, come right to 130 and rendezvous with Hatchet, 8 miles from Bravo."
"On the way."
O'Malley curved around Reuben James and headed southeast.
"Hammer, Romeo, be advised Sea Sprite from Sims just finished off that Charlie for you. We got a well done from the screen commander for that prosecution. Over."
"Tell the Commodore you're welcome."
"Bravo, Hammer, what is it we're after? Over."
"We thought it was a twin screw submarine."
"We're not quite so sure now, Hammer," Perrin replied.
"We've fired 3 torpedoes at this target now for 0 hits. He got one off at us, but it prematured in our wake."
"How close was it?"
50 yards.
"Ouch," the pilot thought.
"Okay, I have Hatchet in sight.
Bravo, it's your ball game. Where do you want me now?"
Morris had allowed himself to fall far behind in the hunt for the now-dead Charlie. On his command, the frigate went to full speed, closing on Battleaxe at 25 knots. In response to the multiple submarine contacts, the convoy was turning slightly south. O'Malley's Seahawk hovered 7 miles from Battleaxe, while Hatchet ran back home for fuel and sonoboys. Again the process of dipping and moving began.
"Nothing," Willie reported.
"Bravo, Hammer, can you give me a rundown of what this target's been doing?"
"We've nearly gotten him twice atop the layer. His course is generally south."
"Sounds like a missile boat."
"Agreed," Perrin answered. "Our last datum point was within 1,000 yards of your position. We have nothing at this time."
O'Malley examined the data transmitted from Battleaxe's plot. As was usually true of submarine course tracks, it was a collection of vague opinions, shaky judgments, and not a few wild guesses.
"Bravo, you're a sub-driver. Talk to me, over."
This was lousy radio procedure, but what the hell?
"Hammer, the only thing that makes the least bit of sense is that he's extremely fast."
O'Malley examined the tactical display more closely.
"You're right, Bravo."
O'Malley pondered this.
"A papa, maybe?" he wondered. "Twin screws, cruise missiles, fast as a thief."
"Hammer, Bravo, if we proceed on the assumption that he's very fast, I recommend you go east until Romeo comes off sprint and can give us a bearing."
"Concur, Bravo. Give me a vector."
On command from Battleaxe, the Seahawk ran 20 miles east and began dipping his sonar. It took 15 minutes to load another pair of Stingray torpedoes on Hatchet, along with fuel and sonoboys.
"What do you think we're after, Skipper?" Ralston asked.
"How's a papa grab you?" O'Malley asked.
"But the Russians only have one of those," the co-pilot objected.
"Doesn't mean they're saving it for a museum, mister."
"Nothing, sir," Willie reported.
Reuben James came off sprint, turning to a southerly heading to bring her sonar to bear on the remaining contact. If only Battleaxe still had her tail, Morris thought. We could triangulate on every contact, and with 2 helos. "Contact, evaluate as possible submarine, bearing 081, bearing..."
"Changing slowly, looks like."
"Yeah, bearing changing north to south."
The data went at once to Battleaxe and the screen commander. Another helicopter joined the hunt.
"Down dome."
This was the 37th time today, O'Malley thought.
"My ass is asleep."
"Wish mine was."
Ralston laughed without much humor. Again they detected nothing.
"How can something be exciting and boring at the same time?" the ensign asked,
unconsciously echoing the Tomcat pilot days ago.
"Up dome."
"You know, I've wondered that a few times myself."
O'Malley keyed his radio.
"Bravo, Hammer. I got an idea for you."
"We're listening, Hammer."
"You have Hatchet dropping a line of buoys south of us. Deploy another line west. Then I start pinging. Maybe we can flush the guy into doing something.
You ever get herded by a dipping helo when you were driving subs?
Not herded, Hammer, but I have gone far out of my way to avoid one.
Stand by while I get things organized.
You know, this one's a nervy bastard.